Welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. It's not just for contracting officers. If you work anywhere in the government acquisition world, this podcast is for you. Today, we're tackling a subcontracting topic, specifically, what is a second-tier subcontractor? All right, let's get right into it. In some circles, the concept of second-tier subcontractors comes with a negative connotation. In other circumstances, the existence of second-tier subs isn't even recognized.
We're going to explain what a second-tier sub or third-tier sub is and kind of talk through the impacts. It can be perceived, like you said, it can be perceived as good or bad, but that depends on your role.
Before we get into that, let's stop and say thanks.
I want to say thanks this week to Adam Veely. Adam is an opportunity pipeline manager at Booz Allen Hamilton in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I want to thank Adam specifically for his exceptional feedback on our podcast. Adam explained how he uses our content, how he buckets it into four specific areas. He uses it for acquisition environment, meaning the overall government contract world, enterprise business development, which is the agency level, the company level, and then opportunity-specific business development, meaning this is a thing we're going after. We're going to go win this. This podcast will help us. And even post-award customer engagement is another way he uses our content for his BD team. So I thought it was really cool that he could tell us, these are the buckets that I put your content in. And I wouldn't have learned that without getting feedback on our podcast. So thanks again, Adam.
Thanks, Adam. Back to second-tier subs. Let me explain what a second-tier sub is. A prime contractor has a direct contract with the government to deliver something, services, supplies. A subcontractor has a direct contract with the prime contractor, not with the government. So this is a subcontract, even though to the sub, it's just a contract because they don't have a relationship with the government. A second-tier subcontractor, because that's what we're here to talk about, a second-tier subcontractor has a direct contract with the subcontractor who has a subcontract with the prime, who has a direct contract with the government, and so on and so on and so on. You could have third-tier, fourth-tier, fifth-tier subcontractors, I imagine.
You explained that pretty well because that's easy to mess up.
What does all this mean? The prime has privity of contract with the government, meaning the government can direct their actions within the scope of the contract. The government does not have a contract with the subcontractor or the second-tier subcontractors.
Or the third.
Or the third, yeah. In general, all direction and communication has to flow through the prime. The government has to tell the prime what they want. Prime has to tell the sub has to tell the second-tier sub.
And this feels like the telephone game sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, clarity of the messages become really difficult as that chain grows. In some situations, the subs or even the second tier below subs, they don't need to understand the big picture. They just got to deliver what their contract says. But if it's not clear what the contract says, then the telephone game. And you end up with something a little bit different than you expected when you put it into the prime contract.
If things are going well, not so much of a problem. But as soon as things start going not so well, if you have issues, that's where this privity of contract and this communication, the telephone game you're talking about, really starts to bite you. Besides this communication and authority direction gap, why else do some people dislike second-tier subs?
Cost.
Yeah, it comes down to money.
It adds a layer of cost. It comes down to money.
The prime contractor has to manage the subcontractors. The subcontractors have to manage the second-tier subcontractors and so on. And it's not just the direct people and time required to do that. But in most cases, general and administrative costs, the G&A costs, are applied to subcontract costs when they're billed to the next layer up. This is how contractors recover the unseen costs of managing subcontractors, like accounts payable, subcontract managers.
We had Christy Gilbert. Actually, I interviewed Christy Gilbert for this podcast a few times. She's a Skyway team member, and that was one of her roles. When she worked for a large business, she was a subcontract manager. And she told me there are points where she had a couple hundred subcontractors and a couple thousand delivery orders. So imagine what it costs to manage just her job. Technically, she's not adding value other than managing those couple hundred subs. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of cost potentially.
Yeah, big companies have lots of subcontract managers, lots of accounting folks that are tracking those costs and the invoicing and paying the bills and all those things. And in general, those costs aren't billed directly to the next tier up, to the prime contractor or to the government. Those are collected in pools and billed through G&A.
And this is perceived to be a big enough cost driver issue, adding these layers. There's actually a clause about it.
I guess now we're into FAR time. FAR 52215-23 is called Limitations on Pass-Through Charges. And this is what you're talking about, Kevin. There's actually a clause that is in most contracts that I'm not going to read, but to sum up, says that you can't have subcontractors doing most of the work. If you're the prime contractor, you have to do a large percentage of the work, or the government starts to get a little bit antsy. Like, why did I even award this contract to you if a subcontractor is doing the work? The reason we're talking about it here with second-tier subs is that's a required flow down. So at each layer, the entity awarded the contract has to do most of the work, or they're not really adding any value. They're just adding cost.
This clause is a great example of a rabbit trail that we'll do a podcast on at some point in the future.
Good point. Moving on. Why are we talking about this? Why is this important?
There's a difference between second-tier subs for services versus products.
From a services perspective, the prime contractor's employees charge directly to the contract. Their subcontractors charge the subcontract, and then G&A, which we talked about, and maybe fee, is applied on top of those costs by the prime, and then those costs are charged to the government. For second-tier subs, here's where it starts to build.
I'm going to follow along here.
For second-tier subs, their employees bill their contract to the subcontractor who applies their G&A and maybe fee and charges those costs to their subcontract. At this point, the prime applies their G&A and maybe fee to all those charges and charges it all, invoices it all to the government. So see how it snowballs there?
And I think you probably just lost a lot of people because it's hard to explain that in a way that it doesn't sound really complicated. And it is. But the feel here, particularly as a contracting officer, is a compounding impact. And the cynical side is this a value-added compounding impact? That was the frustration for me as a contracting officer. As I look at these layers of subs going, okay, as you described, there's a fee on top of a fee on top of a fee. And I'm looking for, okay, does this add value to what I'm doing? And hence the reason that people see this as a negative.
Yeah, it's not just fee. It's cost on cost on cost. So that's services. If we're talking products or solutions or systems contracts, in general, subcontractors are thought of as vendors. There are some subcontractors that may be considered subs, but it really depends what you're buying. It's accepted that a contractor providing a system or a solution will buy parts, or a construction company will hire plumbers or masons to complete the job. All those cost money to manage, direct costs to manage, or G&A costs to manage. But no one gets really uptight about those because they're required to get the job done. At a bigger scale, think about building an aircraft carrier. The aircraft carrier prime contractor has tons of subs and second-tier subs and vendors and second-tier vendors and third-tier vendors. And you don't think about it that much because it takes all of those different specialties to get the jobs done. When you're talking services, that's where it becomes a different story.
And contract type matters too. If it's a firm fixed price contract, as the buyer, I'm not as concerned with the subs that you have because it's just all rolled up into a cost or rolled up into a price.
There you go.
That if it's been competed, it's been exposed to competition. So all of those costs, I don't really worry about them. Well, you know what I mean. But on the cost type contracts, it's a different feel because now I'm seeing each one of those. And that's where that cynicism comes from. I'm seeing each one of those layers get rolled up. And I realize that, you know, we could be paying five or six, in one case, I'm raising my hand, six digits of subcontract costs that they had two or three full-time people who were managing all this stuff that by the time it rolled up, it was six digits of cost to our contract. So now I'm paying attention to it. Whereas if it were buried in the firm fixed price and I'm getting a competitive solution, I generally speaking don't care. So it's very different.
Remember that contractors are going to complete the work in the most efficient manner. If it's a fixed price contract, you don't have to worry too much about cost snowballing because the contractor is going to try to avoid that as much as possible. On a cost type contract, they might not avoid it. They might actually be encouraged to do it by the structure of the contract.
That's a really good point.
It's always good to remember that the contract structure, contract type, even the way it's set up, influences contract behavior. Let's link this to the acquisition time zones and the execution time zones. On the acquisition side, pre-award, in the market research zone, the government is thinking, can this work be done by a single company or do they need subcontractors? Will they need second-tier subcontractors? That helps them decide whether or not they put any formal restrictions on subs or second-tier subs into the RFP, which gets you into the RFP zone when they've released the final RFP and contractors have to write a proposal that is compliant with whatever restrictions or no restrictions that they put in the contract.
Which for one of them could be, thou shalt not have second-tier subs, which we've seen. And that shows up in the RFP zone. After contract award, we move into the execution time zones. In the performance zone, it's about getting the job done. It's about understanding, does the value of the subcontractor impact the ability of getting the job done? So that's where this shows up.
Again, contractors will do whatever is most efficient.
Bingo. In the recompete zone, the question is, does this need to be two contracts next time? Did the subcontractor do enough of the work, like 60%, that it makes sense to do it as a separate contract? Or do we do it like we did last time with a bunch of subs?
Yeah. And if there's a second tier subcontractor, why are they so many levels down? If were they really important and should they get their own award, a separate 8A set aside or something, if they're a small business that qualifies? There's lots of ways to look at it, but the government's considering that in the recompete zone when they're looking at their next contract for this type of requirement.
And finally, the wrap-up zone is where you try to close out all these contracts, and each tier must be closed out separately. The second tier subcontract needs to be closed out before the first tier subcontract, before the prime contract. So you have to fold up the umbrella properly or the whole thing falls apart. And that's something to consider. It's like, how hard is it going to be?
It adds time and energy and cost. All right, let's get specific on the government side. We've talked a lot about cost being a factor, of course, but you really have to look for the reasoning behind it. Is the prime contractor hiring support that's necessary? Or is it essentially a pass-through where all the prime is doing is collecting the costs and then sending invoices to the government? And the clause that we were talking about describes that as no or negligible value, the subcontractor providing no or negligible value.
I can't imagine sending a letter to a second tier subcontractor saying, I have determined that you add no or negligible value to this program. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. If the subcontractors are providing value, then the prime could just be a pass-through where all they're doing is billing the government for the subcontractor's work.
That's what that clause is designed to avoid.
Right. Another way to say it is value added versus non-value added.
And that is a judgmental term. So we're back to the thinking job, is what is a non-value added activity?
For services contracts, we had an episode called Is Bigger Better, where we talked about giant contracts and the impacts that occur when the government issues giant contracts. One of those is that a broad scope and a very large contract means that it's less likely that a prime can do the job alone. They just can't hire all those people or they don't have all the specialties. So subs will be hired. And if you're really looking for hard to find skill sets, as you add more people doing more specific things, should that flow through the prime or should a sub manage those? It's a thinking job, like you said. It may not make sense for the prime to manage a sub if that sub is essential to the original subcontractor's performance. I'm getting it, making it sound confusing again. It's more likely in a products or systems kind of contract. But go back to that aircraft carrier. If you're building an aircraft carrier, the aircraft carrier needs a nuclear power plant. The nuclear power plant subcontractor is going to hire subcontractors to help them build the nuclear power plant. The prime contractor for the aircraft carrier is not going to hire those subs and then try to manage it all.
What about CETA support, systems engineering technical assistance support? I mean, why can't the prime just hire these people? It's the idea being that we're hiring the service contract. Why can't we just hire one company that hires everybody?
Yeah, it's not that easy in reality. It sounds like it's easy.
Sounds easy.
But in some cases, there are strategic agreements that prevent contractors from working with other contractors, so you need to go through another sub to get to them. Sometimes there are organizational conflict of interest firewalls that are there that make it smarter to have a sub hire them so that you can keep a firewall in place. But in a very large contract for services or CETA type of work, it may just be that there are so many companies out there and they don't want to work for this company or that company for whatever reason. Teaming agreements for other efforts, who knows? Maybe they're arch enemies. Sometimes it's not as easy as saying just hire them as the prime.
Another factor is companies like to niche. Companies, particularly small and startup companies or even mid-sized ones, they like to be niche at one thing. They have a whole cadre of employees who are really good at one thing. And that one thing is a small part of a bigger contract. Those people don't want to go work in a giant organization. The right. culture that they've built is specific to that skill set. Government wants access to that skill set. Government should expect to get subcontractors to do it, or expect that their prime is going to get the subcontractors to do it.
Right. And the question is, why can't the prime just hire them as a sub instead of a sub to a sub? And that's where you get into all that other mess of why you might need the layers. Bottom line is, it's not as easy as it sounds. It should be, but it's not always as easy as it sounds.
I think the overall answer is free market.
Exactly.
That's the answer.
Government folks, you have to think about the whole situation. In some cases, how long do you really need the support for? If it's a short-term thing, it might be more efficient to just let those people work as second-tier subcontractors than hire them direct. It just may not be worth all the effort.
I had a big service contract where I was managing a facility and they were upgrading a piece of the facility. So they brought in a subcontractor. They brought in the subcontractor to manage the upgrade. And inside that contract, there was a guy that specialized in this one particular type of software. He was on this task for 3 months. In fact, it was down in a really remote location in the Mid-Atlantic Ocean. And it was cool for him to be able to do on this, to be able to be there for 3 months on this short-term project. But his specialized skill set, we only needed it until the system was up. And then once it was up and running, then this other company could manage the implementation, and then they were going to leave, and then our contractor was just going to manage the ongoing. That's how you hire a sub of a sub, and that's how I learned this. Yeah. Is I'm sitting there thinking, your badge is different from your badge, which is different from your badge. Why is that? And then once I thought about how the whole thing plays out, I don't want this implementation guy here full-time because that's not what he does. This is a maintenance contract. It's not an implementation contract.
You also don't want him reporting to your prime contractor, because what he's doing is directly supporting the subcontract. It's woven into what the subcontractor is providing. You want them to be able to give him direction instead of having to go to you to give him direction and build that telephone game.
Yeah, I did not want one more meeting to sit in.
I guess we're sort of talking about complications on the industry side now. So let's shift over there. I brought this up before. Industry is interested in how to get the job done and therefore the mission accomplished most efficiently. If second tier subs make sense from a get the work done standpoint, that's the route that they'll want to go, or third tier subs or whatever. It's about getting the job done.
One thing to consider is that being a pass-through doesn't help in your past performance. If the government digs into who was really essentially doing the work, you don't get credit for past performance credit for managing the work that another subcontractor was doing. And the reason that's important is you'll sometimes see an evaluation criteria in RFPs for subcontract management. That's a management skill. What we're talking about here is if the sub's doing the work and you have lots of subs doing lots of different work for you and they're second tier subs doing work, that's their past performance they're building that may or may not be directly related to the government. That's a whole different conversation. But you're just managing the people. You're just managing that sub. That's a different skill set.
So when you get to the follow-on competition, what's to stop your subs from saying, we did all the work, we don't need that prime? Or what's to stop your competitors from saying, all they did was hire subs, they didn't actually do any of the work?
Right.
Also remember, industry folks, that if cost is a factor in this acquisition, that snowball effect, the compounding effect of subs on subs on subs, it works against you and it makes you more expensive. Also remember, you have no privity of contract with those second tier subs. So if it's like your example where the sub is doing something for 3 months on a remote island that's directly in support of the sub, that's fine. You don't want privity of contract. You're just kind of getting in the way and making it harder. But if there are problems with that second tier sub, now you can't address the problems directly.
It's an easy way to see that it goes both ways.
And again, services contracting is different than systems contracting. In systems, you may have component and subcomponent suppliers and sub-subcomponent suppliers and vendors. Think about building that aircraft carrier again. Or think about how you buy something in your own life, like a car. That car is built not just by GM or Ford or Toyota or Nissan. It's built by layers and layers of vendors, subcontractors, sub-vendors. We don't even think twice about it. What we care about is, does this vehicle meet my requirements? And how much is it going to cost me? The market takes care of efficiency. Those prime contractors, the car manufacturers, are not going to hire layers and layers of different vendors and subs unless that is the most efficient way to build the vehicle. This is a good point to wrap this one up, Kevin.
Government folks, the second tier sub doesn't necessarily just add cost. I gave that one story already. I had another one where it does add some challenges. The engineer next to me said, oh yeah, we're going to get this. And the guy at the end of the table, who is turns out was a third tier sub, says, oh, well we're going to give you this. And I'm sitting at the table as a contracting officer thinking, what just happened? And I look over and again, you see your badge is different from your badge is different from your badge. And I was new to the program, so I didn't realize he was a third tier sub. But that was a telephone game playing out right there at the table.
Right in front of your eyes.
And here's why this is a good story. If we hadn't taken the time to get us all in the room and communicated what was going on, I would have missed it. Because I'm not the engineer. I didn't understand the technical nuance of that. Because the engineer was sitting at the table and said, no, it needs to be, I think it was like a -7 versus a -6, which meant nothing to me. That's why communication is so critical among government and industry. Because if the industry people weren't all sitting in the room, they'd have missed it. And if the government people weren't sitting in the room, they would have missed it. And if they'd have counted on me to catch it, we all would have missed it.
Yeah. So communication between all layers gets more complicated. The more subs, the more privity of contract you have in there. Because you as the contracting officer couldn't direct that third tier sub. And neither could the prime. He had to tell the guy sitting next to him, hey, tell Joe to do this.
they were literally holding a string with a cup to their ear. That'd be really funny.
All right, that's it for today, Kevin. I'll talk to you later.
I'll see you, Paul.
Okay, that's it for today's episode. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed the podcast, we invite you to check out the Skyway community at skywaymember.com. The Skyway community is the essential resource for anyone at any stage of starting, growing, or running a business with government contracts. We speak GovCon. Whether you're brand new to GovCon, just got your first contract, or you're already a successful government contractor, being a Skyway community member gives you the edge. With our extensive tools and training, exclusive member discounts on consulting support, and a supportive and active community of peers to help you along the way, the Skyway community is the perfect place for anyone who is serious about winning new business. To learn more, call 877-884-5280 or check us out at skywaymember.com. We'll see you next week.